All right, we are talking about what is truly an amazing and many probably of you listening thinking unbelievable story. The story of Leo Wanta, the $27.5 trillion man, President Ronald Reagan's top secret agent or favorite junkyard dog. And here's the thing. You've probably not heard much about Leo Wanta. And we're trying to explain why it's important that you find out who he is. And it's been said that the only thing standing in the way of life and death for Ambassador Leo Wanta is he knows where the money is hidden, that $27.5 trillion, and the Illuminati banksters do not. Well, we will find out from the horse's mouth more about this story when the intrepid Ambassador Leo Emil Wanta joins us on Coast to Coast AM right after this. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you. And Marilyn Barnwell, are you still with us?
I am.
Great. Well, listen, I think we have the aforementioned Ambassador Leo Emil Wanta on the line. Ambassador, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, everybody.
Well, welcome to Coast to Coast. Let me ask you, Ambassador, first of all, do you prefer Leo or Lee?
Well, my mother always called me Lee, and everybody else calls me Leo, and that was my Catholic name. And all the way through grade school, you had to have your St. Leo name, or the nuns would not look at you. But my mother would always call me Lee because that's what she wanted. In fact, my first sister that's older than me was a Sherry Lee, and my brother was a Jeffrey Lee. So Lee was favorite to my mother.
All right. So is Lee?
Fine.
All right. We'll go
real quick for Lee. Real quick.
All right, Lee. It is. Let me ask you, Lee. Have you ever appeared on a sort of a coast to coast radio forum like this ever before?
I've never heard of Coast to Coast until the other day because I really don't have time for TV and radio.
But I guess what I'm asking is have you appeared on a radio forum of this magnitude before, telling your story?
Never. I would not have any time for it, to be frank about it.
All right.
There were so many serious things going on right now with our country and the world. I figured that people have got to know that we're being ripped off.
So this is an exclusive, really, and we're really pleased that you would take some time and join us. Now, are you? I mentioned coming out of a break earlier, going into a break, that you know the only thing that's standing between you and a death, I guess, is the fact that you know where this $27.5 trillion was squirreled away, or parts of it anyway, and the Illuminati banksters who want to get their greedy little paws on it, they do not. Is that a fair assessment?
That is true, but I'm not a politician, so I don't care to cooperate with them.
Understood. Marilyn was explaining, your official biographer, was explaining the mechanism by which you raised this $27.5 trillion. And what I'd like for you to explain is where you put that money. And obviously you're not going to tell us the exact location, but I mean, how does one spread $27.5 trillion in bank accounts around the world and keep track of it all?
Well, first of all, I can remember everything I do and the certain codes. And when I have cash, the banks respect me for cash. Not me, the person, this fact that I represented, that if I said I would do A, B, and C, I would do A, B, and C, pronto.
But you also utilized the Promise software, did you not, to keep track of it?
I have 4 units of Promise. Software is created by Innslaw in Washington, D.C., and it's a great electronic facilitator, shall we say. We can track anything coming and going and where you move it. We can kind of debit your account as well, because we like you.
The $27.5 trillion, was it always understood? Was there an agreement between yourself and President Reagan that the bulk of that money was to be returned to the U.S. Treasury to serve the American people?
Not necessarily U.S. Treasury, but to serve the American people in any shape or form, whatever they needed for the veterans, the VA, because if it gets into Congress, you have no control over it. If it gets into Treasury, the Federal Reserve has control of it, and the Federal Reserve, to me, does not exist. It's a criminal enterprise. They know it, and I know it, and the fact that they know it, it bothers me because they don't do anything to protect the people that they're allegedly working for, because the Federal Reserve System is owned by major banks. So when they give the bailout money, they're ordered by the banks to give them the bailout money free of charge, no interest rates, and you don't have to pay it back, not even a loan. And under a constitution, if I am the Federal Reserve and I give you money, you have to give me something back, like a loan agreement. You just can't just take it and say thank you and drop dead. It's all illegal. It's unlawful. And when Henry Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, told Congress, if you don't give all this bailout to me for all his friends and banks and associates, also foreign banks, you're going to have martial law and civil disturbances and marching on the streets and mayhem and bloodshedding. To me, that's an act of treason, because he lied to Congress, and Congress has not the authority to give the Federal Reserve a single dime without some kind of collateral agreement that the Federal Reserve would give it back. Federal Reserve is a clearinghouse. They're not a bank. They're not an agency. They never were, and they never will be. It's a private enterprise.
The $27.5 trillion that was to come back to the American people to be used. Well, listen, we have the U.S. debt now somewhere north of $17 trillion, not including unfunded liabilities.
Yeah, but that's not true, because that debt means nothing. You have no debt obligations.
That's right.
It's fiat currency. It's not real. It's a computer thing. It's not in hard currency, and it's in fiat currency, so it means it's a moral debt. It's zero out. It's ridiculous.
Okay, so regardless, I mean, that $27.5 trillion could be put to very good use in the U.S. You talked
absolutely.
About
but on sane programs and projects, not some kind of set aside allocation for certain people to get a piece of the pie. There is no pie for them. If it's not good for the American people, it's never going to happen.
All right. And Marilyn, please jump in here at any point to help sort of further this story along. But when did this start to go south for not only you, but for this massive amount of money? When did things start to go terribly wrong?
Well, if you want me to tell you, when George Bush Sr. went to Singapore for his going away from his new going back from his office, which is was never duly elected to, because of the plea bargain with his grandfather Prescott Bush. None of the Bushes have any authority or are able to run under the plea bargain in Prescott Bush for any duly elected office.
That was under the Trading with the Enemies Act.
Correct. At the United Banking and Harriman and all that. Because they agreed that no Bush would ever run for election, because that's how he got out of jail. And all of a sudden they forget about it, because they take the opinion that from administration to administration is only a temporary political thing. And that's wrong. We're not a political state. We are a constitutional republic. So Senior came to Singapore saying goodbye. I was part of his travel arrangements in Singapore. He was going to stay at this, I think it was owned by United or something like that. And I had a cockroach in my sandwich, and I told the Secret Service I was in my suite, we're not going to send them there. We're going to go to Shangri-La or something. And he said, well, I made all these plans for speeches. I'm talking about where he's going to live, where he's going to sleep, and where he's going to be safe without a cockroach in a sandwich. So we had my Chinese partner, who knows everybody in Singapore because he grew up in Singapore. His dad was a warlord in China. And he got us booked, not us, but the president, booked all of his people into the Shangri-La. And everybody in Shangri-La went somewhere else because we kind of threw them out. And I was at the manor at the Secret Service so we could watch what was going on. And I was all the events at the Shangri-La. And I loved it there because I ate there all the time on Sundays. And Bush talked to Lee Kuan Yew, the prime minister of Singapore. And all of a sudden, we're going to have pictures taken at the American School with President Bush and Carol Courtney of the State Department, Howie and I. And I said, hey, well, we'll go pictures with President Bush and all that good stuff. He was excited. As soon as we got there, George Bush was screaming at us because he found out that we owned a nickel credit, one share each, which was originally owned by the Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew and his wife, who's also an attorney or a solicitor in Singapore. So Howie's got his one share from Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister, through his father, and I took my money and bought my share from Mrs. Lee Kuan Yew. So he and I own two shares of a nickel credit, which is a underwriting facility in Singapore under all the rules and regulations, which meant I have to live in Singapore 6 months and 1 day, or else I cannot be the managing director. Howie is the chairman. We both had one share, so we're equal partners. So he comes in and he starts screaming at Howie and I, you guys got $864 billion in a nickel credit. And, okay. Howie goes, why do you know this? Because Lee Kuan Yew was still part of the system, because he would refer some of his friends to us and either gave him a loan or didn't give him a loan, and it wasn't good for us. It wasn't good for Prime Minister either.
Lee, if I could just interject, just for clarification. So you're saying that then-President Bush, and we're talking about George Herbert Walker Bush.
We had $864 billion, and he felt he was entitled, since he was my boss, which is not true. And Howie, being a stupid Chinese guy, he should give up his money too. And I, like a scared Pollock, shall we say, from Milwaukee, I said, okay, I got $432 billion. Okay, I'll give you $216 billion. Howie jumped out of that chair. He says, you were XYZ, XYZ. I pay you no more XYZ. And Howie was he just went off the rocker. I didn't mind losing $216 billion to be alive. Howie refused to have me even participate with giving Bush $216 billion, which was part of our nickel credit. I grabbed Howie, and we went out. And within a week, Howie was dead by rat poison.
Okay, so,
me too.
Obviously very serious allegations, and I have to, you can understand, I have to insist that these are allegations, but
They're not allegations, I was there.
I understand, but you understand my position, I have to.
I understand your position,
right.
But Howie is dead.
Right,
He was my Chinese blood brother.
I understand. I have to use that term, allegation.
No, I understand.
Let me add something, too, that the only reason Lee was also not gotten rid of that night was because he didn't do what they, end quotes, expected him to do. He went downstairs, and instead of calling for the Inico Credit Company car, he went out in front of the hotel and took a cab to the hotel when he was called and told that Howie was dying and that he was in Singapore General Hospital. And Lee took a cab rather than calling for the car. And rather than going to the front door of the hospital, the cab driver took him to the emergency room. And when Lee went up to the room where Howie was, the guy who had called him on the telephone said, What are you doing here? And Lee said,
What
am I doing here? You called me. And go ahead, Lee. I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, that's all right. But I mean, I was shocked. Leo Tetson is one of the top guys of their Homeland Security. And he said, what are you doing here? How did you get up here? I said, what? You called me. What are you talking about? And about 10 minutes later, his wife showed up, and she didn't care one iota if he was dead or alive, my impression. And she gave Leo Tetson all of his security cards because he was also a warrant officer in their intelligence in Singapore. And
so,
I was the only guy that all shook up.
So after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the end of the Cold War, you're at this point trying to get this money back to the U.S. to serve the American people.
Repatriation.
To repatriate it.
Right.
Yeah.
Now
I'm coming home. I'm tired.
But in addition to the assassination attempt, there were trumped-up charges brought against you. You were actually kidnapped at one point. I'd like to get into
Redemption,
that.
And we kidnapped. Pressure,
we've got about four and a half, 5 minutes to the bottom of the hour, at which time we'll break. But let's start that discussion. Talk to me about what happened to you when you were in Switzerland and the arrest warrant there.
Okay. Bill Sessions, the FBI director, through Bill Lucates, the resident agent in charge in Nashville, said, as long as you're going to be out there, serve this on Mark Rich. Okay, for tax evasion. Okay, no big deal. I don't know Mark Rich from Adam because it's Mark Rich and I have a arrest warrant for him. So what? Big deal.
Mark Rich was the last person that President Clinton pardoned before he left office.
Well, I knew it now, but at that time, to me, it's just another photograph and a file. He's income tax evasion and trading with the and bribery and trading with the enemy. That's a normal pickup, shall we say? So we were going to take him across in the ferry to the casinos in France. But I had Lorraine Fine, who was LH Finance, working with us on a number of programs and prime bank guarantees and things. And we were at the hotel Arlock in Lausanne, and she was there with her daughter. Giovanni Farrell was there as my consul general for Somalia. And Vince Foster, I was told by Laura DeAndrea Tyson, the chairperson of the White House, the Economic Council at the White House, to give Vince Foster $250 million in financial instruments made out to the Children's Defense Fund. Children's Defense Fund sounds pretty cool to me, since I love children.
This was a favorite Clinton charity.
I don't know. Well, yeah, it was a charity. I didn't know it was Mrs. Clinton was a chairman. How would I know that at that time?
Right.
All I know is make out that through Credit Suisse, $250 million par value of financial instruments, which would be prime bank guarantees in this case. And I had the bank courier do it so I don't get knocked off between Lausanne and Geneva. And then I had breakfast with Giovanni and Lorraine Fine and her daughter and some other very important people. And we were going to be moving into the Hotel de la Paix at Vince Foster's request, because we were on his American Express card, and he and I were on the same floor. Other people of my staff and his staff were probably on other floors, but he and I were going to be on the same floor. So we were going to go to Hotel de la Paix in Geneva, and I had breakfast with everybody. And by the time I got up from breakfast, the Sûreté decided that they wanted to entertain me for 134 days in a Swiss dungeon with no charges or nothing.
Well, we should point out at this point, excuse me, Lee, we should point out at this point that you had diplomatic immunity because you had been appointed the Somalian ambassador to Switzerland and Canada at this time,
right.
And you were traveling on that diplomatic passport.
Not one, but two of them, one for Canada and one for Switzerland. And I also had my documents that I was a chairman of the Somalia Central Bank, and I had 167 tons of gold bullion warehouse receipts from Somalia, because the banks in Switzerland wanted to buy it at a 10-8% discount. And I told President Haji, that's ridiculous. We'll take a loan against it. And that's why they appointed me the chairman of the central bank, because why give up hard gold when you could take a loan about it and then buy it back or pay off the loan? You still own the gold. 167 tons of gold wasn't too shabby.
But my question, I guess, and I guess it's an obvious one, the answer is an obvious one, but why, if you have diplomatic immunity, you had the diplomatic passports, why would the Swiss police detain you, arrest you, interrogate you for several days without...
134 days.
Without
no
investigating.
No charges filed, by the way, Richard. No charges filed ever. And I've been in contact with the lawyers, with the judges, with everyone in Lausanne, Switzerland, in that court system, and have never gotten an answer to that question of why was he arrested. He was arrested because the state of Wisconsin filed UFAP, a flight to avoid prosecution for the payment of taxes, which was totally unreal. I've got the copies of the paid checks that cleared the bank, $14,129 that were paid twice in 1992, once in May and once in June. So the taxes that they were saying that they had filed this UFAP on, the flight to avoid prosecution on, had already been paid a year, more than a year earlier, because he was arrested on 7 July 1993, and those bills were paid in May and June of 1992.
And even if they hadn't been paid...
It was signed by a cabinet secretary to the state of Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
That's right.
That's how serious this case was.
But
even if
Wisconsin has
question,
no authority beyond their border.
That's what I was going to ask you.
The question is, there was no... It was totally in violation of the Vienna Conventions for them to arrest him, number one. Number two, have you ever heard of any European nation arresting an American citizen because they owe taxes in the United States? I
exactly.
don't think so.
All right, got to take a time out. Lee, Emil Wanta, stay with us. Marilyn Barnwell as well, the official biographer, back with more of our discussion about the $27.5 trillion man right here. An exclusive on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Let me share again some of the words of Marilyn Barnwell in her official biography of Leo Emil Wanta. Again, this is Marilyn speaking. Whenever I talk or write about Ambassador Leo Wanta, I know people will scoff. I know they'll shake their heads in disbelief. Good heavens, they say. No one man has ever created a $27.5 trillion fortune. And when I talk about Leo Wanta, I know I'm placing myself in danger. The people who stole Leo Wanta's money, money that belongs to the American people largely, have held the highest offices in the land, in the political and intelligence worlds, and in our system of justice, in our courts, and in our Congress, and our military. They don't like having this story told. This is the life story of a real man, a story that challenges anything Ian Fleming ever wrote about a man called James Bond. We'll talk more with Marilyn Barnwell and the man in question, Ronald Reagan's top secret agent, Ambassador Leo Wanta, when Coast to Coast AM continues in a moment. Leo Emil Wanta is with us, the $27.5 trillion man, and also Marilyn Barnwell, the official biographer, exclusive biographer of Leo Wanta and the author of Wanta, Black Swan, White Hats. Now, I want to talk a little bit, just a bit, about Ronald Reagan here, President Reagan. It's always been my understanding, Lee, and you can correct me if or disabuse me of this, that was a total outsider coming into Washington and thought in big, bold ideas. And, of course, you would know that firsthand, having pulled off perhaps one of the biggest and boldest ideas ever. But that he was such an outsider, the establishment thought he was such a wild card, they had to have someone supervising him. And that was why Vice President George Bush was sort of foisted upon him on that ticket. Is that an accurate assessment?
It was George Herbert Walker Bush that insisted that he would bring in a big block of votes. And remember, he was the director of the CIA. So they were not going to give up any control to somebody that absolutely refused to be a politician.
Now, how was it that you were, I understand that you were sort of a free agent, you weren't under the employ of the CIA, but you were working under Reagan.
Correct.
When Reagan left office, now you're working under George Bush, you're very suspicious of him and he's suspicious of you. I mean, how do you continue to work in that type of situation and operate as an intelligence agent with your neck out on the line out there?
Let me explain. President Reagan left office January 20th, 1989. George Bush has no eligibility to be the president of the United States. In fact, he went out of his way to fly to California in front of Nancy Reagan, told President Reagan, and I got it from both of them, that he was no longer the president, butt out, stay out of this, stay out of that, don't get involved and everything else. And President Reagan made it very clear, at least to me, and I know others had conversations with him, that there was nobody that replaced him. So therefore, the office is vacant. So therefore, everybody who was in the Reagan administration would continue until there was a duly elected president. Because under the agreements with Prescott Bush and his plea bargaining, none of the Bushes could run for public office. So the job was vacant, which can't be vacant because President Reagan really didn't leave. And that's why he said, continue. Because theoretically, by law in our Constitutional Republic, it's not a vacant. You still have to hold the job until you're replaced. He's never been legally replaced.
So in other words, some of Reagan's administration were watching your back.
Absolutely. Still are today. A lot of us guys, we've never been fired. We've never been pushed out. We refuse to work for them because they really legally and technically have no legal standing.
All right. Back to the location of the $27.5 trillion and sure, their attempts there. And when I say there, let's just call them the banksters, if you will, or the rogue elements of the United States government, rogue, emphasis on rogue, their attempts to get that information out of you. So I guess they tried to do it by imprisoning you, pressuring you. They could have easily have killed you, I suppose, but then they wouldn't have access to that money. So we left off in Switzerland, where you were imprisoned for, was it 134 days?
134 days, and I call it Suite 130. And the only reason I was released, because President Reagan funded the 1992 peace accord between the Israelis and Palestine. And Yitzhak Rabin, who I knew myself, found out finally where I was located, and he sent a letter to the Swiss administration that I better be released. He's going to come over there and steal me away from them, because the 1992 peace accord was $10 billion, five for the Palestinians, five for the Israelis. They were restricted funds. You couldn't use them for arms and ammunition and other finance. It had to go to the infrastructure for the people, and we would have made sure that happened. But in reality, they'll just move the money around somewhere else, and we'll still do what we want to do, but they'll be hiding other blank checks. That's how they operate.
So Rabin tried to intercede. Now, eventually,
he did intercede.
He did.
In fact, let me make a point. One of the pictures that I put in the text, Richard, in Chapter 8, was a copy of the envelope where it's stamped. Rabin's letter is stamped as having been received by the Swiss on November 16, 1993. And they had him on an airplane back to the United States on November 17th, the next day.
And
so he was in New York, in New York court on November 17th. He went into court under Federal District Magistrate Judge Aline Ross, and she dismissed all charges.
As spurious and subterfuge.
That's right.
And you left the courthouse thinking you're a free man, but then what happened?
I wasn't thinking I was free. The U.S. attorney that was hearing my case advised the judge to dismiss all the charges, get them out of here. Because she asked me a very simple question. Mr. Ambassador, please explain why you have this $1 billion security note from the United States. And he jumped right out of that chair, rising to throw the briefcase at her. We dismissed all the charges. Motion to dismiss. I left free. I was free. I'm going back to see my kids.
So the prosecutor didn't want to get into the minutiae and reveal what had really been going on. So they dismissed the case.
He was scared to death.
They didn't want his testimony on record in court in New York in response to the judge's question, Richard.
I love the question because it was paid for.
What happened when you left the courthouse almost immediately?
I was walking down the steps, going to a hotel or wherever I want to go because they had everything in me. And two New York detectives came up to me and said, Mr. Wanta, we have a phone call from the state of Wisconsin Department of Revenue to hold you. I said, what for? I just been dismissed. Well, please come with us. And they took me to where they filmed on Serpico. They had me handcuffed to a pipe there, and then they bought me a soda and some potato chips while I was in the booking. And when we went downstairs for the booking, they told everybody that I was arrested for murder. So everybody would leave me alone or kill me, either choice. I don't know. And I go, murder? Murder who?
Oh, my.
Because they have a big booking group down there. This man's here for murder. I don't know what he gave the form, but... They put me in the Brooklyn House of Detention.
Yeah.
And which was funny as hell, because the Secret Service came and talked to Captain Madigan, told him I was an ambassador. They, in front of him, who took me down to the security office with two Secret Service guys there, they had a gag order for me, a presidential gag order for me to sign, and I could be free to leave and go wherever I wanted to go just to get out of sight and out of mind. And I made a simple question. Which president do you represent? The guy almost ripped off his fingernails, slamming that briefcase down. And Captain Madigan says, what the hell is that all about? Beats the hell out of me. I guess I don't know who authorized the gag order.
Well, at any point, is someone asking or suggesting to you that you can go free if you give them the security codes for these bank accounts?
That from Bush and those guys, clowns, all the time. I call them clowns, and I'm trying to be polite. In fact, the state of Wisconsin... They would release me immediately if I would give them all of the accounts. It was in the Alford plea proposal.
Right.
My trial would stop dead in its tracks if I would assist them returning all this money to whoever. And why would I do that? I could have walked out of the state of Wisconsin immediately, and they would have took me to all my banks and got their collections.
In that Alford plea, it very clearly states, and that is published in the book, that if Lee, as part of that agreement, he had to list all of his assets everywhere in the world.
Right.
Now,
and if I violated even one of them, I go back to trial.
Yeah, I mean, it was an obvious, you know,
shakedown.
Threat. Yeah, shakedown. Good word.
And then at some point, you're transferred to a prison in Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah, and that's because CIA General Counsel Martin Hager came to Kettle Moraine Prison to interview me, and he must have said something to the warden, because he was CIA, he was the chief counsel for the CIA, Jan Morton Hager, and he was the attorney I used to buy the Ionian Bank in Greece. I gave him $500 million for a bid bond, and we won the bid. So I would have owned the bank in Greece, so we wouldn't have had all the default in Greece, because I would have moved a lot of cash up there just to protect the country. And at 3:15 in the morning, they woke me up and took me down to where the bus comes in to take you. I'm going to Oklahoma. And the prison lieutenant says, I don't know what's going on. And he gave me a big hug. He says, I know who you are. I said, I know who I am, too. And he and I are still the best of friends. So for 24, 25 hours, I'm on a school bus going down to Oklahoma. Wow, I'm going to Oklahoma. You can't take me off out of the border. State of Wisconsin can't send a prisoner to any place except the state of Wisconsin.
They were trying to bury
you. Oklahoma.
They were trying to bury you.
Down there. Hmm?
How did they do that? How did they try to get you killed?
Put me on a school bus and chains and shackles, and away I go.
But was there a hit order on you while you were in prison?
Well, three guys came into my private cell. I was the only guy in that prison with a own private cell. They came in, there were three guys, and one guy's stroking himself. He's going to rape and plunder me. And I was sleeping, and they banged my head against the cement wall. And that got me mad. I thought it was back in Vietnam. So I figured, okay, three characters. And I got rid of two real quick. And the third guy, was hanging over the railing on the second floor, and the sergeant kept running up. Want it, don't drop. Sergeant, he ain't going nowhere. He took his feet. I had him such a headlock, he wasn't going anywhere. And after that, because the people in the unit, which was 94% black, knew I was the ambassador representing Somalia. So they were my protection. But the guard down there unlocked my door electronically, and they came in. And he's got this alum, he's stroking,
And the bitter irony of all this is that despite being worth $27.5 trillion, you couldn't even pay for your own lawyer. You had a court-appointed lawyer who really didn't know anything about your case.
But I'm not entitled. He was never appointed. He was only appointed to put me in a medical institution so they could put me forever drugged.
That's right. They appointed this man to see Lee through
the medical evaluation.
And the prosecutor, Douglas Haig, Judge Torpy, and Douglas Haig, the prosecutor, wanted Lee to have mental evaluations. They wanted to get him in a funny farm where they could control the money and drug him to get whatever information out of him that they could.
Now, being ward of the court, I couldn't do nothing.
While you're buried in prison, Lee, my understanding is that these banksters and this rogue element of the United States government that wanted to get their mitts on your money went around to these foreign banks because they had uncovered some of the cash and were telling the people at the bank, you know, you can turn the money over to us because Lee Wanta is dead. That's why they had buried you in prison.
Dead. But the interesting thing, Dr. Connie Lee, who was the chief psychiatrist of the state of Wisconsin, she came for my first evaluation. I told her where I was, and she probably thought I was nuts. She says, do me a favor. Please, do me a favor, doctor. You don't know me from Adam. You have your files, which I don't know what they are, and I don't care because I don't believe they're true. Please call Vice President Al Gore. I gave her the number 202-456-XXXX. And the moment he picks up the phone, you go, Albert! And he'll know you are calling for me. She called. She kept me outside of her office with two guards. She called. She was on the phone about 35 minutes. She came out, says, Mr. Ambassador, would you like a glass of milk, a soda, some cookies? I'm calling the sheriff's department. You're not going to stay in here any longer. I don't know what's going on. I don't want any part of it. But the vice president absolutely said you were dead, and you were, because I appeared in front of the Select Intelligence Committee on many occasions when he was a senator. She says, I don't know what's going on, but you're out of here. You're not insane. You are not bipolar. You could run this place, and I would work for you. I said, well, thank you, doctor.
So she actually dialed the vice president, and he said that you were dead.
Vice President Al Gore.
And he said that you were dead. He said that you were dead.
She was very, very brave, Richard, because she wrote three times they tried to get this done, and three times this doctor stood up and said, no, there is absolutely no mental illness here.
How much of the money?
All the nuts were in Madison.
How much of the money is still out there, Lee? How much of the $27.5 trillion is still out there in your bank accounts?
Right now, it's $30 trillion. I have a deal with the bilateral tax agreement with Austria and the IMF and the United States. I put this into motion about a year ago, right, Marilyn, something like that?
Right, that's right.
And they agreed, and so there's $30 trillion that they know of. So, in other words, living in Austria, where I live since June 1988, I'm an Austrian resident by Austrian courts, filings, and everything else, because I was a director general of New Republic, which required I had to be there running the company. So the $30 trillion, according to the inland tax laws in Austria, they get a flat 50%. So I told the IMF, Christine Lagarde, to be my escrow agent, whatever she decides with the United States and Austria for their division, her fees, is half of the $30 trillion. So I would walk out tax-free $15 trillion, and I would be billing high-speed rail, and whatever else, the veterans, hospitals, I don't care what. I'm 74 years old in June. I would have spent all that money my way on projects for the people of the United States. Because if I give it to the Treasury Department, it'll go to the Fed Res, it'll go wherever it goes, and I don't know. But with the half, or whatever they're getting of the 15T, that $17 trillion, we claw that back for the bailouts because they're illegal. It's nonsense. We don't have a national debt obligation of $17 trillion. I would have even gave you more. Plus, me making more progress, I knew in 2006 when my $4.5 trillion was sent to Bank of America in Richmond, I knew within 2 years I would have wiped out your debt. It wasn't $17 trillion at that time. Because I would have made money, and you would have charged me 35% on every transaction. You were a gold digger, but go for it.
What happened to that $4.5 trillion that got wired to the Bank of America?
I accused, through my attorneys, I went to court and everything else, and they said they didn't steal it. They converted the money. The chief counsel of the Federal Reserve Bank in Richmond testified in front of Federal Judge Ellis that everything Ambassador wanted to say was true and correct. They released from the Federal Reserve by $4.5 trillion to Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury. So we dismissed them as a defendant in the suit, which was 02-1363-A in the federal courts in Richmond. We won, and Judge Ellis and everybody was happy, as Larry, because I was getting my money. I went to Citibank for 2 months waiting for Rubin and Senior to give me my money because the Federal Reserve said he had it. So I'm not going to go back to wherever when I go to Citibank where we know it was there in Goldman Sachs. But they allegedly say they committed no crime. They didn't steal it. It was converted. In other words, I'm not capable of spending my own money.
Now, for those of you, again, who are maybe, you know, scoffing at this and thinking this is too unbelievable, we need to point out that all these court documents are embedded in links in your book, Marilyn,
right.
Wanta, Black Swan, White Hat. Just about a minute here to go before the top of the hour. Explain how people can get a hold of this book online so that they can read it themselves.
Right. There are two ways, actually. It is online at Amazon.com on Kindle, because Kindle, and I do want to get it onto ebooks with Barnes & Noble, too. I haven't had time to do that, and because that will let you have access to all of the links and the documents. The other way, anybody who's listening can go to the website that was set up for Ambassador Wanta, and it's called http://, of course, wantarevelations.com.
All right, and we'll take a break. We'll take a break. If you're both good to stay with us, we'll open up the lines and take some calls as well, discussing the unbelievable $27.5 trillion man here on Coast to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't you dare go away.